So today there's one last thing I have to tell you about frame fields. And then we're going to talk about push forward and pull back. And at the end, depending on how much time we have, we're going to start talking about differential forms. So let's start with the frame fields thing that's left. Right now, we know how to do frame fields that are going to be generators for vector fields. We can do the dual co-frame fields. Those are going to work with covectors or one-forms. The thing that we still don't know what to do is how to deal with tensors. And to do that, I need to extend the tensor product to tensor fields. The way we define the tensor product, it was at a point. You have tensors at a point, so in some vector space, and then we can take the tensor product of two of them. Well, now, if we have T and S and they're both tensors, then T times S is a tensor field. So it's going to take a point in the manifold, and it should map it to a tensor at point A. So we take A as the first coordinate as usual, so the projection works as we expect. And then we just take the tensor T at point A, tensor product with S at point A. And this is going to live in and I'm going to write where it lives in. It depends on the ranks of these and these. So just to make things simpler, I'm just going to avoid having to figure out what it is. But the important thing is that we have two tensors. We take the product of them. We end up with another field defined through the tensor product. Well, now that we have this, if EI from 1 to n is a frame, and epsilon I is the dual coframe, then if T is a tensor field, of type RS, then locally we can write, it depends on whether this frame is local or not. If this frame is local, we can do this locally. If it happens to be global, we can do it globally. But we can write T as a combination that looks like this. So just as we did for tensors at one point, we can write it as a linear combination of tensor fields tensored with each other, the frame and the coframe fields. And now these things here are not just numbers, these are functions. And they're going to go in general from some subset of the manifold to R. And I'm assuming here that the fields are defined from a subset of M to Tm. So this is what you have seen so far whenever you talk about tensor fields. And whenever you see those things that are the components with the things with indices times the basis, you usually skip this thing and just talk about these things here. Those are functions, not just numbers. And then, of course, at each point, you evaluate them at the point, and you get numbers. And as an example of this thing, we're just going to look at, using our notation, a metric field like the ones you're used to in general relativity. If M is a manifold, a metric on M is some tensor that goes from, tensor field that goes from the manifold to T0 to M. So it's going to be a type 0 to tensor. We want it to be defined everywhere, so it's going to be a global vector field. And it needs to satisfy these two properties. If G at point A is the pair A, GA, so GA is a tensor at point A, which means it's actually a map that goes from TAM times TAM to R. This map needs to satisfy some things for this to be called a metric. The two things that needs to satisfy are GA is symmetric as a map from TAM times TAM to R. So if I feed it two vectors, if I swap the order of them, you get the same answer. And also GA is non-degenerate. I'm not going to go through the definition of what this means because we're actually going to see it later on when we talk about symplectic structures. But the simple way of doing this is that if you look at these in coordinates, if you look at the components in some basis, the matrix of components should be having determinant different than zero. But there's a more abstract way to define this thing, but we'll see it later. So now that you have this, in a local chart, U and the coordinates, I'm going to call them x0 to xn minus 1, just because that's what we usually do in relativity. Then if you do this, because this is a tensor field of type 0, 2, we only really need the dual coframe to do this. So dx0, dx1, all the way to dx. N minus 1 is a coframe, is the one induced by the coordinates. And then we can just write G locally, so restricted to U. G is going to look like this. G mu mu dx mu tensor dx nu, where G mu nu, each one of them is a function from U. So this is what you usually do when you talk about this tensor. And the way we interpret this thing is through the notions that we have so far of how to take the tensor product of two fields, because these are now tensor fields we're tensoring. And this is the product of a function times a tensor field, which, as we've seen last time, is still a tensor field. And then at a point, GA is now going to be given by G mu nu evaluated at A times dx mu with the subscript A, which remember now is just a linear map only acting on TAM, which is what we want, tensor dx mu at A. So this is the picture at one point. This is the picture globally. I cannot put any A's in here, because if I start putting A's, then this becomes a number, and this becomes a covector instead of a covector field. So this is just to tie together the notation that we're using to what you're used to. Any question? Is all of this clear to everyone? Yes?
What does it mean exactly by non-degenerate?
Non-degenerate, if you want to be precise, means that, so we need to look at a point, because that's what we're saying, so GA acts on vectors. So what it tells us that if GA, U is used already, V1, V2, is 0 for all possible V2 in TAM, then this implies that V1 is 0. This is the formal way of saying that something is non-degenerate. But then if you look in a basis, this is the same as saying that the matrix that you associate to this bilinear map has a determinant different than 0. Any other questions? So the next thing we're going to talk about is the push forward. And the push forward is the answer to the following question. If I have a function between two manifolds, M and N, which is smooth, and we know how to define smoothness, what is the derivative of F at some point A in M? Because so far I told you how to find out if a function is smooth, but not how to tell you what the derivative is, which is kind of backwards from what you may be used to, because in calculus, you first look at derivatives and then say, well, this is smooth if it has all the derivatives, they're continuous, and so on. So we are kind of going backwards. Now, I'm not going to ask you how do you think we do it, because either you already know or you don't. It's not the kind of thing that you can easily figure out. But as we've done with other things, I want to give you some intuition first by looking at what happens with Rn, and then we'll do manifolds. So suppose now that f is a function between Rm and Rn. So they are not necessarily the same dimensions. For this function to be differentiable, which is the requirement of this thing being smooth in the first place, the way you actually define differentiability with a function of many variables is not by looking at its derivatives. For a function of a single variable, you just say, OK, I take the derivative. If it exists, it's differentiable. That does not work with more than one variable. So you have to go through a complicated thing that looks like this. You say there is a linear map that I'm going to call df, also differentiable at a point. So let's say differentiable at x0. If there is a linear map that I'm going to call df with the subscript f0 that goes from Rm to Rn, such that if you take the limit for x that goes to x0 and you look at the norm of f of x minus f of x0 minus df x0 evaluated at x minus x0, and you divide by the norm of x minus x0, this is 0. Now, this is not really important for us, it's just the way it's defined. But the important thing is that differentiability is associated to a linear map that goes between Rm and Rn. This is true even if I have the function being defined in a subset of Rn. Even if I have a subset here, this function still goes from the whole Rm because it must be a linear map. It must act on a vector space. And as it turns out, we're not going to prove this because it's not a calculus course, but it turns out that df x0 is very much related to derivatives, because df x0 acting on a vector v is actually going to be I'm going to use the standard basis in Rn, so I can write V as Vi Ei. Then we're going to have Vi df over Xi evaluated at x0, and then, df j, because f is a function that has n coordinates as output, so we need to pick some of them, and then we multiply it by e j. Again, so I'm not going to prove this, but what this is telling us is that this is a linear map. If you look at the components of a linear map as a matrix, they are these ones. Just the derivatives of all the components of F with respect to the various components of X. And this is just a Jacobian matrix. So this linear map that we associate to a differentiable function at the point is actually the Jacobian, just as a linear map instead of a matrix. So remember that matrices and linear maps are pretty much the same thing in the sense that you can represent a linear map as a matrix, and then if I give you a matrix, you can just do matrix vector multiplication to make a linear map out of it. So we're going to use this as a motivation to define the same thing that we're going to call push forward on manifolds. Any questions about this picture first before we get into the complicated one? Yes?
So this function dfx0 takes something in Rn.
Yes.
You are saying the vector v is some element in Rn because the vectors are the same thing.
Yes. Yes, so this is a vector in Rm and the output is a vector in Rn. So actually, even though I use the same notation, the index I goes from 1 to m, the index j goes from 1 to n. So this matrix is not necessarily a square matrix. So it could be, depending on the dimensions, it's going to be some matrix, maybe 3 by 2, 4 by 5, it could be anything you want. And the linearity is easy to see because this is essentially a matrix product. I'm multiplying this matrix by the vector v. So that's where you get the linearity. And this whole thing here, we're not showing, again, that's the proof that's for a calculus course, not for this. That's the part that's important to us. So we would like something that kind of looks like that. So now if I actually have a function that goes between two manifolds, which is smooth, and A is a point in the manifold M, then I want to define df with the subscript A to be a linear map between some vector spaces. Now the question is, which vector spaces do I choose? Any ideas? Yes, the tangent spaces. When we're working with Rm and Rn, it's obvious which ones should we take. Rm and Rn are vector spaces, but the manifold is not a vector space in general. And the only vector spaces that are intrinsic in the manifold construction are the tangent spaces. And all the other weird spaces, but wouldn't make much sense to take cotangent spaces, for example. So we're going to take as the first one TAM, and then we're going to use the fact that the function f takes point A to the point f of A to map to T f of A n. We need to do this because A is only a point in M, so if we need to choose some tangent space here, we could choose any other point, but might as well take the one that the function maps A to. So we want our function to be between these vector spaces and to be linear. So how do we do this? DFA acting on a vector v has to be a derivation. At the point f of a. Because this is an element of TFAN, and we define the tangent space with the construction that we've seen in class as the set of derivations at this point. We call that then curves. And actually, if you remember the tutorial about curves, I gave you a function that was kind of the same as this, but at a capital D. I just used to differentiate. That would have been the push forward if we had used the other notion, which is the one of curves instead of using derivatives. So to do this, we need to specify how this acts as a derivation. So the definition is going to be dFA acting on the vector v. This whole thing here is a derivation. So if I feed it the function f, which lives in C infinity n r, I need to get a number out of this. And the only thing that we know here are that there's a function f, there's a function v. So to spit out the number out of this, the easiest thing we can do is actually take v, which itself is the derivation, and act on the function f composed with capital F. Now, this thing here is a function that goes from m, then we take m, feed it to f, that spits out something in n, then we take that, feed it to f, and it gives us something in r. And because we're composing smooth functions, it's still going to be smooth. So this is actually a smooth function that lives in C infinity m r. V is a derivation at a in m because it's an element of this space. So this thing can act on this thing and give us a number. So this is how we define it. And the things that we have to check are whether it's actually linear and whether it's actually a derivation. Because so far, it's just something that we define. The linearity part is easy, because if I look at dFA of alpha times v, then you get alpha times v evaluated at this, but we defined operations pointwise, so alpha comes out. Similarly, you can do the same if you sum two vectors. So this one I'm not going to prove because it's quite easy. It just comes from the fact that v itself is linear. To see that it's a derivation, we need to check that the product rule works. So this one we can do. So let's see what happens if I have dFA acting on v. And then I take this and I act on the product of two functions, f and g. Now, by definition, this is v evaluated at, and then we have f g composed with capital F. Now, the trick is that because f g is a pointwise product, taking the product of this composed with f is the same as first composing f with capital F, then g with capital F, then we take the product, because things are pointwise. So this is v of the product of f composed capital F and g composed capital F. So really, this is the only part of the proof that really needs something, because then v is a derivation, so it satisfies the product rule. So for this one, you get f composed capital F, and then this you evaluate at a, because v is a derivation at point a, times v acting on g composed with f. And then we have the other possibility, so g composed capital F at a, and then v acting on f composed capital F. And at this point, we just realized that this thing here is just d FAV acting on G. And similarly, this one is the one acting on F. And then this is F evaluated at F of A. So you do this plus the other thing, and you see that indeed, taking this derivation acting on the product is the same as taking the first function, you evaluate it at the point, but the derivation is at F of A, so it should be evaluated at F of A. And then you multiply by the derivation only of the second function. Plus, you swapped the functions around. So it's a derivation, it's linear. So indeed, this map is a linear map between TAM and TFAN. So this is pretty much, starting from what we have there, which is our motivation, it's pretty much the only thing that we can build that makes sense. With the ingredients we have, if we want a linear map, it needs to be between tangent spaces. And if we want it to associate to a vector VA derivation, this is the only thing that I can do without knowing anything about these functions. F is an arbitrary function, V is an arbitrary derivation, F is arbitrary, A is an arbitrary point. The only thing that makes sense is that one. Okay, does the actual construction make sense to everyone?
I didn't follow the argument in the last line.
This one?
Yes.
So this thing, by definition, we have it here, V acting on some function composed with capital F is the same as dFA of V acting on F. So this thing is the same as this. This is just F composed with capital F of A. We can just act with the capital F first, and then we have F of capital F of A. But proving that this is satisfies the product rule means that this thing, which I may call something else, we could call it just capital X, so we don't have to write it all the time. Capital X acting on F times G is going to be the function F evaluated at the point of the derivation, which is F of A, times X acting on G. And then the next step is going to be plus G at F of A times X of F.
My confusion comes from how we could separate V acting on FG into a sum.
This one?
Yeah, into a sum.
V is an element of TAM. So V itself is a derivation.
Oh, I see.
So V satisfies the product rule because I fed it the product of the functions.
Okay, I got it.
Okay, so now the thing we need to show is that this thing actually makes sense, and it gives us the same thing as the one I wrote over there in the case of Rn. Yes?
I'm slightly confused about the meaning of the small t. So when we acted on something which is a C-infinity function, so tf, which takes from manifold to R, it changes into a covector, essentially, right?
Yes. So
here it's changing a function from two manifolds.
Yes. So this is a very good question. So at this stage, D is not some operator. At this stage, DFA is a symbol. It's just some name that I'm giving to this function that somehow tells me it's the push forward. That's the D part, just so I remember this is the push forward. The capital F tells us it's the push forward associated to capital F. A tells us it's at the point A. So this is just some name that we're giving to the map. I know that it's thinking of this actually as a function, D as something that acts on A is useful. And the problem with what you're thinking is that that only works with F is a function that goes from a manifold to R. Otherwise, it doesn't really make sense. You could kind of think of it as being something which is a vector-valued operator, but it's kind of weird.
It does make sense in the way that if n is actually R, so my capital F is C infinity function from M to R, and then df is just the tangent manifold to
yes.
R itself, which is the same, it's a vector space itself.
Yes, so indeed in that case, if n is r, then yes, this ends up being the same thing, which is why we're using the notation, of course.
Right.
Because in that case, then that works. So for example, if you look at the coordinate function xi that go from some subset of your manifold to r, then if you try to do dxi a, seen as a map that goes from tam to r, which, as you were saying, is isomorphic to the tangent space to r, then this indeed is pretty much the same thing as the dxia that we had defined before. So of course, we are using this specific notation because it fits with everything else. But at this stage, and also for these ones, until I tell you about differential forms, these are just symbols. D is not something that acts on something else yet. It will be at some point. So the last thing to do for push forwards, by the way, I didn't write it down, but this map is called the push forward of capital F at A. That's the name for it. Sometimes it's also called the differential of F at A, which is also what we sometimes call that map there. So the only thing that's left to check is what happens if we act on a basis. This is a linear map, so we associate a matrix to it by checking what happens in a basis. So we're going to use a coordinate chart to find the basis. In fact, we need coordinate charts because you have two manifolds. So we're going to use a chart U I think I need to give it a name. So I'm going to call this phi, which is x1 to xm. So I'm going to use m for the dimension of capital M and n for the dimension of the other one. So this is going to be in the atlas of m. And then I have the other one I'm going to call the v psi. And these ones are going to give them y1 to yn as names. This lives in the other atlas for the other manifold. And they are such that A belongs to U, and then capital F of A belongs to B. So I'm choosing the charts that are around the points that we're interested in, around the point A in the manifold, and around the image of A in the other manifold. So now I can look at dFA acting on d over dxi at A. This is one of the basis elements over vector space. So because it is linear, if I look at what happens on the basis elements, I know what happens everywhere. And because it is a derivation, I need to see what happens when I act on a function. So by definition, this is d over dxi at A, which is an operator acting on the function f composed with capital F. And remember, the way this thing acts is by doing the derivative with respect to the ith argument of this function, and then I precompose it with phi to the minus 1. And evaluate this thing at phi of A. This was just a definition of these things as derivations. And if I want to write this in a better way, I can expand like this. I can write di, then I have f. I wanted to use the chain rule at some point, so I need to have two functions, and both of them need to go from some r to some r. So phi to the minus 1 takes things that are real coordinates, then maps them to points in the manifold, f maps them to the other manifold. So if I want to get something which is coordinates, I need to also compose f with psi. So I just introduce a psi to the minus 1 composed psi composed f composed phi to the minus 1, acting on phi of a. It's pretty much the usual trick we use. And now, this function and this function are just take coordinates in and split out coordinates. So for these functions, we know how to take derivatives. So we can actually split up this using the chain rule. So if we use the chain rule, we're going to have the derivative with respect to the j coordinate of f composed psi to the minus 1. And then we have to evaluate on this whole function acting on this point. So phi to the minus 1 cancels phi. Then we get f of a, and then we get psi of f of a. And then we multiply by the I derivative of psi composed f composed phi to the minus 1. We need to take the jth component of this, and we evaluate at phi of a. Other than the fact that the compositions are annoying, if you just think of this is the I derivative of function times another function, that's just the chain rule from calculus. And at this point, we may want to give better names to things. First of all, this is actually d over dy j evaluated at f of a, acting on f. Just as this was the action of d over dxi, it gives us this derivative. This is the action of the d over dyj. These ones live in the n manifold. So we have this, and then these ones, this, if you remember, is just the coordinate representation of the function f. So I'm just going to call it f at, and this is just a at. So just to make things easier to look at, this is going to be equal to this, which multiplies f at j, then we take the derivative with respect to xi evaluated at a at. So you can see why this kind of looks like the Jacobian, because if you look at this, that's pretty much the same. It's just that now I have f at, and instead of x0, I have a at, because I had to take coordinate representations. But this is pretty much as close as we can get to the Jacobian. And then if I realize that, okay, so f is an arbitrary function, I can just write in general df a acting on d over dxi at a as df at j over dxi evaluated at a at times d over dyj at fa. So I can write this as a linear combination of the basis vectors in the tangent space on n. And the matrix elements are exactly the elements of the Jacobian. So in this sense, this map is equivalent to the Jacobian. And of course, if you are working with our n and our m, if you take the charts to just be the identity map, then putting the hats or not doesn't change anything, and you get exactly the same thing as the one. So in this sense, this notion generalizes the idea of the Jacobian matrix. But it only uses information that's inside the manifold. We're not using the fact that it's embedded into anything. So it's a good way of defining these things. Are there any questions about the push forward of a function? Okay, so next we're going to do something which is a bit less obvious but a lot more useful. So in practice, this is helpful because it gives us a notion of derivative, but we don't really use it that much. We do need it to define the pullback though. And the pullback is going to be more important for us. So as you can imagine from the names, the pullback and the push forward are kind of doing opposite things. The push forward takes a vector in M and maps it to a vector in N. That's why we call it push forward. It takes something and it pushes it using the function to a point, a vector based at f of a. The pullback kind of does the reverse. If I have a function from M to N, which is moot, the pullback takes something in N and gives us something in M. That's why we're saying pullback. The function goes one way and the pullback goes the other direction. Now, I don't know if people call the push forward first, and then they say the pullback is the opposite, or they call the pullback first and then they name the push forward, or maybe they name both of them at the same time. But that's the usual name they get in differential geometry. So the idea of the pullback is take So the pullback takes some fields on N to fields on M. And one of the biggest differences between the push forward and the pullback is that the push forward acts only at a point. The push forward takes a vector at a point and maps it to another vector at a point. The pullback takes fields and maps them to fields. And in general, you cannot do the same with the push forward. Not unless F is a diffeomorphism, but then what happens is that you really use the pullback in disguise. So this is something to remember. Push forward is at a point. Pullback takes whole fields to all fields. Just not all possible kinds of fields. There isn't an overall general definition of a pullback. I need to define it case by case. So we're going to start with the case of functions, which you can think as the simplest kind of fields that you have. If f is a function that goes from n to r, and as usual, we want it to be smooth, then we can define the pullback of this function through the capital F function. So we say its pullback by capital F is F star F. This is the usual notation. When you want to do the pullback of something, you take the function that you are using to pull back. You put a star, and then you put the thing you're pulling back right after. So this thing is the function F composed with capital F that goes now from M. So essentially, if we have a function that lives on n and associates real numbers, if we want to build a function of m out of it, and we have this function capital F that maps m to n, the simplest way of doing it is first to use this function. You take a point in m to a point in n, and now this one you can act with this function. And again, this is the only way that doesn't use any external information that we have of making this work. And then, of course, you can take some weird function of this. So if you wanted to, I guess, nothing stops me from defining this is the logarithm of this thing. You could do it. Doesn't really help, but you could. It wouldn't have all the nice properties that the pullback does. Next, I want to define the pullback of a covector, really a covector field. So if alpha that goes from n to Tn is a covector field, Then I'm going to define its pullback, and I denote it by f star alpha. This one is going to be now something that goes from M to TM, and it's still a covector field. So I want to be able to take a covector field to another covector field, and the way I define it is this. F star alpha at point A, acting on a vector V, is going to be the following. So again, I only want to use the information that is given at this stage. We don't know what alpha is. It's a generic covector field. So the only thing we know is that it acts on vectors in a linear way. And f is a function that takes m to n. We don't know anything else about it. V is a vector that lives in m. So v lives in TAM. But we don't know how to do things on m. We're assuming that this alpha lives on n. So when you do pullback, essentially, you need to do everything that has to do with your operation on n and somehow feed the map something that comes from m. So the only way we can do this is by acting with alpha itself at point f of a on some vector. Because you would like this acting on v to give us a real number. So the only thing we know how to do is take alpha and act on another vector that gives us a real number. Any ideas how we can get out of all the information we have a vector that lives in T F A N? Yes? Yes. That's why I defined the push forward first. The push forward is exactly what we're looking for. It takes a vector that lives in TAM, maps us to a vector that lives in TFAN. So in here, I'm just going to put DFA of V. So it looks a bit weird if you think of it like this. But again, if you think of which other way do I have of building a map which is linear that takes a vector in TAM and maps a real number of the ingredients that we know are just this and the function f, that's the only thing we have without any external knowledge or any other structure. And we're not going to check this, but indeed, if you do this, you're going to get a linear thing, it's going to be smooth, so you actually end up with a covector field. And next, we're going to define the same thing for tensor fields, but not all of them. So finally, if T that goes from N to T0S, N is a tensor field, so we can only take the ones that are of type 0s. They are the ones that take vectors as input. If this is a tensor field, then we can define f star t as a tensor field of the same rank, but on m. And the procedure is pretty much the same. This generalizes the idea of covectors, because remember, covectors are a type of tensor. They would be tensor of type 0, 1. So to do this, we're going to define T at point A. And now T at point A is a map that takes vectors as input. So this acting on V1, V2, to Vs, because there are S entries, we define this. This should be f star t evaluated at a. We define this by looking at what t does to vectors. So same thing as before, we have t at point f a, and then we evaluate on the push forward of each of these vectors. So they're going to live now on the tangent space on the other manifold. So df a of v1 all the way to df a of vs. And again, we're not going through all the steps, but you can see that this is still a tensor field. It's going to be linear, it's going to be smooth, and it does everything we need it to do. Okay, so this is what the pullback does. And without any extra information, you can only define the pullback on these things. You cannot define the pullback in general on things that take covectors as input. And the reason why is that the only way we know how to push things forward is by pushing forward vectors, not covectors. The pullback has some properties that it's useful to mention. Actually, there's only one property that's useful to mention. So property. The pullback is always linear. In the sense that the pullback of a sum of two tensors is the sum of the pullback of the tensors, same for vectors, same for functions, and so on. So there's that property, and then we can see what it does in coordinates. So to see what it does in coordinates, we're going to start by only looking at the pullback of a specific covector field, which is this one. These ones are, I'm using the same notation as before. So this is now a map that goes from V in N to Tn. This is a local covector field, so I can define the local pullback of this thing in the same way I defined it before. So if I want to see what it actually does, I have f star dyi at point A, and I can see what it does on one of the basis vectors here. So d over dxj evaluated at A. Now this by definition is dyi evaluated at f of a, and then we act on the push forward of this thing. So df a of d over dxj at a, and the push forward is written somewhere on these boards. This is just going to be dyi f a. So this is going to be df at k, we need one extra index, over dxj. And then it's going to multiply d. This is evaluated at a at. And then we have d over dyk at f of a. This is a linear map. These things are just numbers. And these acting on these gives us a delta, because this is the dual basis. So eventually, this ends up just being d f at j over d xj evaluated at a at. And because knowing what happens when I act on a basis tells you everything about the map. If I want to write this as an actual covector field, it turns out by looking at this thing that f star dyi is going to be df at j, df at I over dxj evaluated at a at. Actually, I will not put this here at all because it's the function multiplying something times dxj. So that's what it does in coordinates to this specific subset of all possible things. And then if you want to know how it acts on a generic one form or a generic tensor, we just need these two things. So actually, the work properties, I just had to tell you this first. So other properties. If f is a function that goes from n to r, and t is a tensor from n to t0s n, then the pullback of f times t is the pullback of f times the pullback of t. So the pullback is compatible with multiplying a function by a tensor, and also is compatible with tensor products. So f star of t tensor s is f star t tensor f star s. By putting these two things together with what we know about the local basis for covectors, we can find what happens to everything. Because remember that by using these things, the dyi, I can write everything else. They generate all of the covectors, but they also generate all of the tensors of type 0s. So for example, if I know that the tensor t locally looks like Tij dyi tensor dyj, then if I look at f star t, this is going to be f star of tij, which multiplies f star dyi tensor f star dyj. And then how to do these two, you can see from there. So these are going to have some of the Jacobian matrices coming out. And this is just tij composed with capital F. So these things now are functions that act on a manifold M and give you real numbers. So if you want to know the actual expression in general of f star of some tensor, you can use this. It's going to have a lot of matrices and indices and so on. But every time you don't remember how to do it, you just use these properties to find it. And in general, your tensors are going to have just a couple of indices anyway. Okay, so that's everything about pullbacks. I did not have time to introduce differential forms at all, so we're going to do that on Friday. Are there any questions about what we've done today? Yes?
Is there a particular reason that push forwards can't be defined for fields?
So it turns out that if you try, so first of all, the question, in case people didn't hear it, is can we define well, is there a reason why we cannot define push forward for fields? So you can do it point by point. So you might ask, okay, so if I do associate to each point the push forward at the point, can I just merge them together and make it into a field? You can do that, but it's not going to be smooth, generally speaking. You have no reason why this procedure should be smooth because it is a point by point procedure. The only way in which you can do that is if F is not only a smooth map between M and N, but it's a diffeomorphism. So it's invertible and the inverse is also smooth. And then if you do this, you can actually make this into a map that acts on fields. But that's because you have a duality. Now, if that's a diffeomorphism, you are using the fact that you can take the inverse can pull back between M and N. So then you can pull back the covector field, and then you make the covector field into a vector field. So it's just the way it's defined. You can break things if you try to just patch them together point by point. While this, because of the way it's defined, automatically makes things into fields, because it starts by taking fields as input.
Maybe if you have a metric defined.
So even if you have a metric defined, it all depends on the function you're using. So the function is the thing that gives you the way of mapping things. So we're using the push forward, so we're pushing things from one place to the other. So if the question is, can we take a vector field and map it to another vector field, then yes, you can try to use the metric and so on. But what we're trying to do is things between different manifolds. The metric will be the manifold itself. So you can take a vector field and map it to another vector field, but it's in the same place. So if you want to map between two manifolds, you need a way of going from one to the other. But if the function is not invertible and the inverse is not smooth, this procedure is not going to work the way you want it. And the problem is that F may not be injective. So then you have ambiguities when you try to do this. Okay, we can finish here. I'll see you this afternoon for the tutorial.